Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is renowned scientist Neil Shubin, author of Ends of the Earth, Journey to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Neil also authored three other books, Some Assembly Required, The Universe Within, and the best-selling book, Your Inner Fish. Neil is a professor of organismal biology and anatomy at the University of Chicago and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2011. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Professor, your work spans several decades of adventurous travels to both the Arctic and Antarctic regions to conduct research. But before we get into your book, can you tell us about your background and how you got involved in the research?
Yeah. So I trained as a paleontologist, as a field paleontologist, you know, learning to find fossils in different parts of the world. I originally set off to work on early mammals and dinosaurs, but nowadays I work on fish and the transition from life in water to life on land. But when I was a student, I was invited, this is in 1988, I was invited to be part of a small four-person team working in East Greenland. And that expedition to the polar regions really changed my life. And it's been almost four decades working both in the Arctic, leading my own expeditions, and in Antarctica.
And you discovered a fossil fish with arms?
Yes. Working in the Canadian Arctic in a place called Ellesmere Island, my team and I worked for about 6 years to find a fossil fish that tells us about how fish evolved to walk on land. And this fish, which is about 375 million years old, has arm bones inside its fins, has lungs and gills. It's a real intermediate between fish and land-living animal.
That's amazing. So your book offers us a glimpse into this largely unknown world of Antarctica with its fast-flowing glaciers and underground lakes and blood falls and living water bears. And we'll get to all of that and more. But you start the book with a different understanding of the dynamics of how ice reacts under pressure in your first chapter, Ice is Hot. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So, you know, having worked in both the Arctic and Antarctica, my whole world was changed. I mean, it's changed the way I see science, changed the way I see the planet, changed the way I see humanity. And the big part of that is ice and how it behaves. So ice has a melting point of 32 degrees. Right? And that's where it turns from liquid to solid or solid to liquid. Well, that's kind of close to the ambient temperature of the Earth. So it doesn't take much temperature change for ice to shift in state from liquid to solid or back again. And that's very different from a substance like steel, where the melting point might be hundreds of degrees, you know? And so ice sort of sits at the knife edge of always melting or forming a solid again. Doesn't take much change in the environment, doesn't take much change in the temperature to shift ice, and that can affect us profoundly.
Well, speaking of profound, in your prologue, you had a very profound paragraph that I'd like for you to read.
Oh, of course. Kidoki, so polar regions encompass 8% of the total surface of the Earth, but hold an outsized influence on the state of the planet. Almost 70% of all the planet's fresh water is frozen in ice. On land, permafrost in the polar regions holds 1,600 billion tons of carbon, roughly double that in the entire atmosphere today. Locked in the soils and ice of the poles are clues to our past and things that will shape our planetary future. Every milestone of human evolution, from the origin of our species to the establishment of our social structures and technology, arose during a time of ice at the poles. Freezing and thawing over millennia, the Arctic and Antarctica are like vaults that hold our planet's heirlooms. When polar regions melt, the vaults are thrown open. Ancient water, carbon, and microbial life return to the surface to shape and change our world.
And you traveled to Antarctica, and you spent some time there, and you discovered quite a bit there. Can you tell us about it?
Well, it's incredible what you can find. So just let me set an image for you. Okay, so my team works on fossils. So we work on rock, not ice. So where there's no ice, there's typically rock. So we work on what's called the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, which are mountains that poke through the ice. So here's an image. At the top of these mountains, with ice 1,000 miles all around, in Antarctica today, when you crack inside those rocks, you see sediments that were formed in ancient rivers and streams, and we find the creatures that lived in there, ancient ones, 380 million years old, sharks and fish and other creatures. So inside the rocks is a tropical world. Outside is a polar one. So that it shows just how much our planet can change just dramatically over the eons. But it also shows how fast our planet can change, you know, in the course of our own lives. So it's remarkable the amount of change that can happen on the in the polar regions.
So you found water bears. What are those?
Water bears, the tardigrades, are little tiny microscopic creatures. They look like little teddy bears. They have like little arms. They look like they have little arms, not real arms, and they have a head. And they look really cute, but they're kind of microscopic. It takes a you need a specialized light to see them. But are they durable? They can withstand pressure and temperature and hostile conditions that could kill any other creature. They're cute, but they're renowned for being incredibly durable. And they exist underneath, in some places, underneath the ice. And here's the surprise. Miles under the ice, sometimes 2 miles under the ice, lie freshwater lakes, some of them the size of Lake Superior and the Great Lakes. And these lakes hold life, hold microbial life. And to some, they suspect that there are tardigrades in some of them, these water bears.
I found it really interesting when you were in your chapter, Ice is Hot, when you're talking about the properties of ice and how, I think you called it metastable. Well, one of the things that really intrigued me was that the more pressure there is on ice, that the ice at the bottom begins to melt.
Yeah, so you can have liquid water underneath the ice. Like, you know, those lakes I was just telling you about, that's probably one of the reasons why you have these massive lakes. There are about 600 of them underneath the ice because, you know, so the melting point of ice depends both on temperature, 32 degrees, but on pressure. So at higher pressures, the melting point's a little higher. So you can have liquid water there. And the motto is, anywhere you have liquid water and ice, strange things can happen. And truly strange things do when you have water underneath the ice.
My guest is Professor Neil Shubin, author of Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. So when this ice melts because of the pressure on top of it, the melted ice at the bottom creates somewhat of a slide for the glacier.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine it almost like a lubricant for the glacier to slide over the rock. You know, so that's so when you think about ice in Greenland, we have a huge ice cap, and in Antarctica, we have a massive ice cap. That ice is always moving. Our satellites, NASA has launched a number of satellites to map the ice, and you see it's always flowing like rivers almost. They call them ice streams. And they flow from the center of the continent towards the coast. And they move fast, sometimes about a kilometer and a half or about a mile a year. That's enormous. And that's because not only is the ice kind of melting in places, but you have this lubricant. The ice can serve as the water can serve as a lubricant underneath the ice, enabling it to move.
So when the nations set up all these scientific research outposts in Antarctica and they leave and they come back, it seems like they'll be in different places.
Sometimes they are. So if they're on the ice, yes, definitely they're moving around. The McMurdo Station, which is the big one run by the United States, is actually on volcanic rock along the coast. Some of them are on the coast on the rock. So you have rocks along the coast. Some of them are there. Some of them are on the ice. You know, the United States set up a military base up in northern Greenland back during the height of the Cold War. And that thing fell apart because it was in the ice. And the ice is always moving. And it just collapsed.
Well, you wrote about the American outpost in Antarctica, as you mentioned, called McMurdo, and another Russian outpost called Vostok. And from these stations and others, scientists are traveling to all these remote regions and making discoveries beneath the ice and apparently from out of this world.
Yeah, it's really astounding. I mean, honestly, the reason why I wrote this book is because the science done by these scientific stations really does change the way you see the world. It's stunning. And, you know, what you say is out of this world. Well, what you find in the ice are meteorites. The ice is always moving, and sometimes it moves, has meteorites inside. And the way it moves, it collects meteorites in certain parts of Antarctica. So the U.S. Antarctic Program has collected over 50,000 meteorites in the last four decades. And those meteorites sometimes are pieces of the moon that have landed on the Earth. Some are pieces of Mars that have landed on the Earth. Truly remarkable. And these are windows into the solar system that have landed on our planet. We don't have to launch, you know, missions to outer space to get them. They come in us. We just have to collect them. And they really revealed some fundamental things about the origin of our solar system.
So what happened in 1959?
Remarkable time. Height of the Cold War, right? Russia and the U.S. were part of a geopolitical struggle. Well, those two nations, along with 10 others, sat down at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., United States National Academy of Sciences, to sign an incredible treaty called the Antarctic Treaty. And it committed nations to only the peaceable use of the continent. No military bases, no extraction industries, only science was allowed. Furthermore, countries weren't allowed to make land claims, or at least not recognize the land claims of other countries. So nobody can claim, can honor the claim that any other country has in Antarctica, meaning it's a purely international reserve. A place the size of the continent, larger than the size of the continent of the United States, is purely international and dedicated entirely to science. Can you imagine? What an amazing treaty signed at the height of the Cold War, and since it expanded, it now includes over 50 countries. Truly remarkable.
That is amazing. So how come that didn't happen in the Arctic Circle?
Yeah, the Arctic is a little bit different, right? So the Arctic is already carved up. You know, so in the Arctic, you have Arctic islands on one side. You have Greenland, which is controlled by Denmark. You have Canada, which is a series of islands that project in the north there. And then you have Alaska, which is the United States. And then you have Russia's Siberia. So it's already been carved up by countries. Now, the part that hasn't been carved up is the ocean floor underneath the North Pole. Because if you remove the ice from the North Pole, you have just ocean floor, and nobody has claimed that yet.
So, yet.
Yes, I heard that. That's the key word.
So, Professor, working in extremely cold environments is obviously dangerous. So can you talk about the 7 rules for scientists working in polar regions?
Yeah, I got a bunch of rules that my colleagues and I have lived with over a period of time. The first is don't get hot and don't get cold. The first two are don't get hot and don't get cold. Obviously, don't get cold, because if you get cold, it's hard to heat up. You can get frostbite, all that stuff. But don't get hot either, because when you're climbing a mountain in Antarctica and it's cold, you don't want to sweat, because when you sweat, you get wet, and there's nothing more dangerous, and before that, nothing more miserable than being both wet and cold. So don't get cold, don't get hot. The other is don't get dry, because Antarctica is super, super dry. You often are at altitude, maybe 7,000 feet. The air is some of the driest air on the planet, and it's very easy to desiccate in that cold environment. And that affects skin, that can affect your hydration levels. So you have to be really conscious about hydration. Another rule is it takes a village. Everybody has to look after one another. You know, you really do function on the buddy system there. And we help each other. You know, I'm always looking at my colleagues to see what their shape is, and they're looking at me. You know, because if you're about to suffer the frostbite or about to suffer bad conditions or going down in some physical way, you're often the last person to realize it. So it takes a village, if you say. The other is mental, is really you got to think. You know, sometimes we talk about like thinking outside the box. Well, in places like this, you have to think inside the box. When things go sideways on you, when it's really hard, when it's not really good, it takes a village, but it also takes focusing on what you can control, the variables you can control that are at your fingertips. And that is just a wonderful strategy for succeeding in very, very complicated times. And, you know, that's so it also means you really have to focus on well-being in a very big way. So safety and well-being, I think, are our first goals for working there. It's not science. I want to make sure everybody comes home. I want to make sure everybody's, you know, healthy. And that means really focusing on your physical and mental well-being as much as others. And the other rule, which is really important, is I'm an expert. I've been there for a number of years. I know other experts, but experts mess up. So sometimes you can get arrogant. Sometimes you can ignore things because you think you know too much. And you have to stay humble, because not staying humble there can really lead to problems, because you can overlook safety concerns. So there's lots of rules that polar researchers have developed. Some of them have been used by the Inuit who worked in North for a long time. Others have been learned the hard way.
Well, before we switch poles, I want to see what this McMurdo, That's the station down in Antarctica. Can you describe for us what that looks like, what the population is, and how does that relate to the Russian station, Vostok?
So McMurdo Station is the main U.S. base, U.S. scientific station on Antarctica. In the United States, we run three stations. One's at the South Pole. One is on what's called the peninsula region of Antarctica, and the other is McMurdo Station, and McMurdo is the largest. So it has a population of about 850 in the summer, in the Antarctic summer at the maximum. It shrinks to about 100, 150 in the winter. And it's basically where is the entry point for science in McMurdo. It's also the staging station for science in Antarctica. And it's like a base, which has dormitories, obviously, and cafeteria and so forth. But it also has the various stations and shops inside that will support science. So there's the field support center, where they store the tents and the sleeping bags and all the gear that's necessary for crews to go out. There's the flight support center, which has the aircraft, the helicopters and so forth. There's the carpentry shop that builds specialized gear and equipment for the expeditions, and on and on. So it's a really well-run base, a well-oiled machine. Pretty remarkable to work there.
And talk about the Russian base, Vostok. That's further east, right? And can you describe the conditions, atmospheric conditions?
All right. Well, Vostok is in the middle of the ice cap. McMurdo is on the coast, on the rock, and Vostok sits on the ice. And it's actually in the middle of the ice, about, 1,500 miles from McMurdo. So it is thousands of miles from anything else, really, just on the ice. And there are a handful, maybe a maximum of 50 scientists and support staff that are there, Russians. And it's famously the coldest place on Earth. I think the coldest reported temperature on planet Earth is at minus 125 degrees Fahrenheit, and that was recorded at Vostok. So a legendary bunch of people, the Vosties, they call them. There have been rumors coming out of there that for a period of time they had to ban chess because people got violent around that. Things happen to your brain when you're wow. That far removed. Yeah. It's a pretty remarkable outfit. And they've done some incredible science there, by the way.
Well, there's a discovery that was made in Antarctica called Blood Falls. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Blood Falls is pretty remarkable. Now, it's closer to McMurdo Station. So when you fly out of McMurdo, you're about 158 miles out of McMurdo flying over the ice. There's a spot that looks like there's it sounds like blood pouring out of the glacier. And it's remarkable. You can see it from miles away. And for a long time, people thought that Blood Falls was basically a red patch of algae that grew on the ice. Because we know that algae can grow on the ice. We know that red algae can grow on the ice. So for a long time, it was thought, that's just a particularly large patch of red algae. Well, scientists, again, working out of McMurdo Station, looked into the ice, and they found something truly remarkable. At the bottom of that ice is salt water. So underneath that ice is salt water. And what you have is the red is not from an algae. It's actually from that salt water, which in its interaction with the rock below produces red rusty liquid. So it's really kind of rust that's kind of gained from the interaction of the salt water with the rock below. And that spills out. So it's basically that's kind of rusty water that spills out. Now, why would you have that at Blood Falls? Well, the geological reconstruction suggests something really incredible, that as the ice of that area grew over time, and it did grow over the last 5 million years, it captured a small amount of ancient ocean underneath the ice. So that is salty water. And the reasons why it's salty water is likely because it's a patch of ocean that was trapped under the ice, separated from the rest of the sea hundreds of miles away. And that salty water, set off this chemical reaction, which produced the rusty outflow, which gives the Blood Falls its red color. So really a remarkable story.
It really is. And what surprised me was I wouldn't expect anything living in Antarctica other than penguins and the people that went there, but you guys found a lot of living things there.
Exactly. I mean, the more you look, the more you find. So teams based out of Montana State University found all kinds of microbes living in that salty water. You would never think there'd be living creatures there. You would never think that there'd be living creatures miles underneath the ice in those lakes we were talking about. But yes, they're there. And there's whole ecosystems underneath the ice. And think about that for a second. These are ecosystems of creatures that have been separated from the surface for millennia, if not millions of years. They've been separated from the light of the sun for that length of time. And they've had to evolve all kinds of ways to get energy. If they're not getting light, how are they doing it? They're ultimately getting their energy by breaking down the chemical bonds of various chemical compounds underneath the ice as well. So really remarkable what we're seeing, what life can do underneath the ice.
Well, meanwhile, they were undisturbed for most of the time until we found them. But
yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
The Arctic was not so fortunate. We've been roaming around the Arctic for a really long time. Can you tell us about the early explorations by Norway's Nansen and his vessel, the Fram?
Yeah, pretty amazing. So the Inuit have been living there for thousands of years. And the Europeans, for the past few centuries, have been sending expeditions up, you know, to map the areas up there, but also maybe to claim the North Pole as their own and, you know, sort of political, geopolitical interest. Now, Nansen, well, Fridtjof Nansen, was one of the amazing explorers, because he's one of the first people to make a science of polar exploration, that he distilled it as from a science. He observed the Inuit and learned how they lived up there. He observed what it takes to survive in the cold temperatures, all those rules and so forth that we talked about earlier, about how to survive there. Nansen was big into thinking about physiology and how humans can endure in these places. So he designed a ship to explore the Arctic, and knowing something about currents, he set this ship up so that it could be carried by the currents close to the North Pole. And it was really remarkable. He used ocean currents to project a ship as far north as anybody's been up to that time or close to it, and then made a little run for the North Pole. He didn't quite get to the North Pole, but he got close enough. And yeah, he really changed how people think about exploring polar regions because he made a science out of it.
And there were some recent discoveries of stuff they left behind.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, so my team and I, one day we were walking up in the Arctic, and we discovered some artifacts from Nansen's ship. Nansen didn't command the particular mission we found the artifacts from. This was after his expedition. But it was from the ship, the Fram, which was the name of that ship. It was some smashed crates from when he had originally worked up there.
Wow. And yeah. Who was Lady Jane Franklin?
She was a remarkable person. She was married to John Franklin, Admiral John Franklin from the British in the 1800s. He was famous for he led a large expedition up to the map, the rocks of what's known to now today, the Canadian Arctic. But he never came back. His ships were lost. And he didn't come back for a few years. And so she was a sponsor of research up in those areas. So she, to try to find her husband, she sponsored all kinds of research. And ships launched to find John Franklin up in the Canadian Arctic, what is today the Canadian Arctic. But a lot of science was done as a consequence of that. So she was a real catalyst by searching for her husband, which was a failed search because he had passed away. She didn't know that at the time, but she had launched all kinds. She had helped enable lots of expeditions that went up there, which essentially changed the way we know these places.
So what's the big deal about Greenland? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Greenland in the news, given Donald Trump's obsession in purchasing it. But yes, that interest is not new. It goes back generations, right?
Yeah, U.S. has always had an interest in Greenland. We had military bases up there. But Greenland's taking new importance, not as much as the Arctic. Well, the Arctic is melting, you know, 4 to 7 times faster than the rest of the planet. So ice is disappearing. We know that. And so ice is disappearing very fast. So now these areas are open for economic development. They're open for oil and gas extraction. They're open for, you know, navigation routes that were closed before by ice. They're open for fisheries. But it gets even crazier and stranger. And actually, something that's going to dominate the news in the years ahead is underneath the North Pole, on the ocean floor beneath the North Pole, lies a mountain range that's on the seafloor. And it extends as a ridge about 1,000 miles from Siberia on one side to Greenland and Canada on the other. And when you look at the rocks of that mountain range, they were originally formed not in the ocean, but they were formed in the continents. Likely back in the geological past, they have continental ties to Russia, Greenland, and Canada, meaning each of those countries can make a claim to have territorial rights to an area about 2 to 3 times the size of Texas on the ocean floor beneath the North Pole.
Oh, no.
So the largest patch, yeah. So countries are now contesting for this huge region, and it's going to be a big geopolitical struggle in the years ahead.
My guest is Professor Neil Shubin, author of Ends of the Earth: Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Professor, before Europeans ventured into the Arctic, there were indigenous people there, as you mentioned. So tell us about them and what lessons were learned from them.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, their history. And some of it we really don't know because it's oral culture. But we know there was a population, at least in the Canadian Arctic, called Dorset. They were around there for several thousand years. Then about 1,500 years ago, they disappeared, their culture, and were replaced by what's known as the Thule. And they were largely nomadic peoples. as you know, subsistence and making a living out of these in these extraordinary places. And they devised all kinds of technological and social practices that allow them to survive there. One of the main ones is their code of ethics. It's a code of ethics that they subscribe to that dictates how they support each other as a community, how they support elders and what the responsibility of elders are in the society. But also it dictates their relationship with the land and the landscape and how they should have respect for the land and the ways to behave on the land. So they have almost an ethical code, which is a series of behavioral aspirations and rules and expectations that really foster their living up in these conditions. You know, it takes a village, and that's what that's all about.
So what is Prison Island?
Prison Island is a nickname given to a town or a region of the Canadian Arctic where a population of Inuit were moved from the south, this is back in the 1950s, they were moved from Quebec all the way up to what today is 1,500 miles north to Ellesmere Island. And they were promised that they would have better hunts. They were promised if they didn't like it, they'd be able to go home. Well, they moved four or five families up there to what's now known as the village of Grease Fjord, and they left them alone, left them there. And they were essentially ripped and displaced from their traditional land. Remember, they're deeply connected to the land and the cycles in the land. They were disconnected from a land which originally supported berries and hunting birds and so forth to a land which is extremely different and doesn't support life as well. And so the families that were moved there called this place Prison Island because they felt that they were becoming human flagpoles. They were pulled north by the Canadians to really support Canadian geopolitical interests in the Arctic. And so they felt that they were being served as almost flagpoles, if you will, to support Canadian interests. And the place got known as Prison Island because they felt this wasn't their home and they were moved against their will.
And now, because of all the man-made problems, the ice is melting and releasing pathogens?
It can, yeah. So that's what's clearly happening up in the north. So there's a team from Canada that was kind of looking at the water that was melting out of some of the glaciers several hundred miles from the North Pole. They sampled it with modern DNA technology, and they found inside it were microbes, many viruses that could infect animals and plants up there. So the concern is that with a warming Arctic, you have melting water, right? And that melting water is releasing viruses that have been frozen in the ice for millennia. But at the same time, you have creatures moving from the south to the north because it's getting warmer up north. So at the moment you have increased numbers of creatures coming to the north, they're now exposing increased numbers of viruses that are emerging from the ice. And so that's certainly a situation to keep an eye on.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. What lessons do you want readers to take away from your book?
These places change the way we see the world. They change the way we see how life works. They change the way we see the workings of our planet. They change the way we see the cosmos. And they change the way we see our place in nature. It's been a remarkable privilege for me to work up there for almost four decades, and I wanted the readers to share that.
Unfortunately, we're out of time for the exchange today. Thank you, Professor, for writing this book.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
My guest was Professor Neil Shubin, author of Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of the Life, Cosmos, and Our Future. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR.